A neutrino is a subatomic particle considered to be one of the fundamental building blocks of our universe. Its existence was first proposed in 1930 as a desperate remedy by Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli to explain the imbalance of energy during radioactive decay, but it would remain a matter of speculation until experiments in 1956. In a new book called Neutrino Hunters, The Thrilling Chase for a Ghostly Particle to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, Ray Jayawardena, a professor of observational astrophysics at the University of Toronto, tells the story of that groundbreaking discovery and explains the research into this elusive particle and the implications it has to science and our understanding of how the universe and life were created. It's published by Scientific American, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and I'm pleased that it brings Professor Jayawardena to our show today. Welcome.
Great to be here, Leonard.
In addition to being a professor, you're also the author of two other books, one on the possibility of life beyond our solar system, the other on the science behind how stars and planets are born. Wouldn't both of those topics also require a discussion of neutrinos?
Not directly so much. Neutrinos do have a lot to do with why we are here several stages. First, the universe might not have been dominated by matter as it is, perhaps if not for neutrinos in the very, very early times right after the Big Bang. And also neutrinos have an important role to play in triggering, perhaps, in the destruction of stars, massive stars at the end of their lives, when they explode as supernovae. And those supernovae are important for life as we know it because they produce some of the elements that we need for life.
Are they still a mystery for us, even though they were discovered over a half century ago?
Oh, absolutely. We've learned a lot about neutrinos, and yet they remain incredibly mysterious. They're tough to catch because they hardly ever interact with other particles. So they stream right through our bodies and right through our planet, and at nearly the speed of light. So they're very difficult to characterize because they're difficult to nail down. And the number of very mysterious and almost fugitive aspects to their character. For one thing, they come in three different flavors and they morph among them. It's almost as if, you know, chocolate-flavored ice cream turned into vanilla.
No, wait, they're streaming through our bodies, but they come in different flavors.
They do.
So right now I'm getting all three flavors streaming through my body.
They change flavor as they go through, so as they travel through. So that, you know, you're sitting
but
there.
But what does changing flavor mean?
It means
what they look like.
Yeah, they kind of come in three different varieties, and those varieties have slightly different characteristics, and they change morph from one to the other as they travel through. So as you're sitting there, there's literally trillions of neutrinos that originated in the nuclear furnace at the heart of the sun streaming through your body. Thankfully, they don't do any harm and they don't really, you know, they hardly leave any trace. But they're right there. They're all around us.
And they're being created all the time.
They are.
Unlike other things, which were all created at the time of the Big Bang.
Well, they're created in nuclear reactions, but they also sometimes get absorbed in nuclear reactions. So they are like some other elementary particles.
One of the first experiments done to collect and count neutrinos was the Homestake Mine experiment, headed by Raymond Davis and John Bacall in the late 1960s. This is in a mine in a town called Lead, South Dakota.
Indeed.
Why there?
Oh, great question. So the reason that Ray Davis decided to go underground to detect neutrinos is to get away from the noise, the signals of all the other particles that you have to deal with when you're on the surf on the ground. Whereas if you go deep underground, the earth itself, the layer of the earth, acts as a filter and filters out all the rest. But neutrinos have no trouble getting through, and therefore it's much easier to detect neutrinos deep underground or deep under the ice in Antarctica. When Ray Davis and John Bacall got going on this experiment, their goal was to detect neutrinos coming from the sun and therefore directly confirm our ideas about how the sun produces energy, namely through nuclear reactions.
Well, why is a neutrino trap, a tank filled with 100,000 gallons of tetrachloroethylene? That's cleaning fluid, isn't it?
It is. So the reason is that you basically need a very, very gigantic amount of material, whether it's dry cleaning fluid or heavy water or ice, in the case of Ice Cube, the Antarctic Neutrino Observatory, you need a huge volume, basically, because neutrinos hardly ever interact with anything. So basically, you're waiting for, you know, that random chance that once in a while a neutrino would interact with an atom, and therefore you can detect its presence.
You detect its presence through the interaction, not because you can spot the neutrino itself.
Exactly.
This is what the case with so many subatomic particles.
Indeed. So it's a huge challenge, as you might imagine. It's hard to, you know, detect them and then therefore be able to study them and characterize them.
The same thing happened with the Higgs boson. We never really saw it. We just saw the reaction to it colliding with something else.
We see its presence exactly in a collision.
Now, so we have this thing in Lead, South Dakota, another one in the Arctic.
The Antarctic.
What have been the results?
Oh, absolutely. So
we been catching neutrinos?
Absolutely. So the vast majority of neutrinos that have been detected come from the sun or from collisions of particles from space with the upper atmosphere of the Earth. But there are also ones back in 1987, astronomers detected a handful of neutrinos, just two dozen neutrinos, coming from a supernova explosion in a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. It's the first time until recently the only time that we had seen neutrinos that originated from beyond our solar system.
And how did we know they were from beyond the solar system rather than from our sun?
Oh, because of the particular energy characteristics of the neutrinos, and also the fact that there was a single burst that coincided in time with the explosion of this supernova. Most recently, with Ice Cube in Antarctica, scientists have detected for only the second time neutrinos coming from deep space. We actually don't know exactly where they originate. Chances are that they either come from supermassive black holes at the hearts of galaxies or from the death throes of massive stars. Either way, they're giving us clues about some of the most violent corners of the cosmos.
My guess is Ray Jayawardena, who has written a book called Neutrino Hunters. It's published in collaboration between Scientific American and Farris Strauss and Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that neutrinos are the fundamental building blocks of the universe, yet they still continue to elude scientists. Aren't there anti-neutrinos as well?
Oh, for sure. There are anti-neutrinos as well. And we one of the fascinating and elusive questions is whether neutrinos and antineutrinos interact with matter in identical ways or not. It's an idea that has been around for a long time, and it's only now that experiments are getting to the point of being able to test that.
Well, are they like antimatter or
are they? Oh, they are indeed. I mean, they just like, you know, other particles like electrons or protons have antimatter twins, neutrinos do as well.
But neutrinos can be both positive and anti, can't they?
Well, neutrinos are neutral in terms of electric charge, so they have no electric charge. So both neutrinos and antineutrinos, neither of them have a charge, but they have this other property called spin, which is a quantum mechanical property that could be different between the two of them.
A neutrino is considered an elementary particle. What are the features that define a particle as elementary, and what roles do each play? I mean, what's the difference between what a neutrino does and what a fermion does, or a boson, or a muon?
Well, the definition of elementary is that particle cannot be broken down any further, that it's not a composite of other particles. So in that sense, neutrinos don't break down into smaller constituents.
Except in string theory, I imagine.
Well, not really directly in this. Well, so in the realm of sort of the standard model of physics, they are elementary. They are, you know, just like quarks or electrons. They don't break down any further. Whereas protons and neutrons do. They're made up of quarks. The fascination with neutrinos is because they have connections to an incredibly wide range of phenomena, from the early days of the universe to exploding stars to the nuclear reactions in the heart of the sun. But even the Earth itself produces neutrinos, because right under our feet, inside our planet, there are radioactive elements. as these elements decay, they produce heat. So the interior heat of the Earth is at least partly coming from radioactive decay, and that decay also produces neutrinos that we can detect now, just in the last few years.
Is all of this research just theoretical, or can it have practical applications?
That's a great question. So it's certainly starting to be used by geologists to understand the interior of the Earth. In my book, I talk about a number of suggestions how neutrinos might be put to practical use. One of the most seriously investigated prospects is the idea of using neutrinos to monitor nuclear proliferation.
So we could actually aim neutrinos at Iran to find out if they're...
It's the other way around. It's the other way around. It's that anytime you run a nuclear reactor or carry out a bomb test, that releases neutrinos. Mm-hmm. So if you had a neutrino detector from some distance, you might be able to tell if somebody was operating an otherwise hidden nuclear reactor.
And how far away is that kind of capability?
That's the challenge. So for now, you need to be with the kind of detectors that we have. They're hard and difficult to deploy, unwieldy. So they need to be pretty close. But you know, in many cases, monitors from the International Atomic Energy Authority, for example, you know, they need ways of monitoring the operations of a particular nuclear reactor. So they could, with agreement from whoever is operating it, place a detector and keep monitoring, make sure they're not doing anything they don't claim to be doing. So that's one of the most seriously investigated ideas. But there are much more far out and perhaps, you know, science fiction type ideas of using neutrinos for communication.
Because to send information over something like radio waves?
To send information right through the Earth, because they can travel through the Earth rather than having to use radio waves or other kinds of waves to travel around the Earth. You might gain a few milliseconds of advantage. Somebody's actually suggested linking the world's financial centers with neutrino beams. Of course, this is far from realistic at the moment, to gain a few milliseconds advantage for equity trading. Others have suggested using intense neutrino beams for interstellar communications, possibly someday.
One of our listeners, Jim, asks on Twitter, does the discovery of dark matter and energy change our understanding of neutrinos?
Well, there's actually a connection. Back when we didn't know whether neutrinos had any mass and how much mass they did have, there was a possibility that neutrinos, because they're so plentiful, might account for some of the dark matter whose gravitational impact we see. But it turned out they do have mass, but the mass is just way too puny to account for the dark matter. So unfortunately, neutrinos are no longer a good candidate for in accounting for dark matter of the universe, which means that we are continuing to look for other particles as candidates that could perhaps explain dark matter.
My guest is Ray Jawarana, a professor and the Canada Research Chair in Observational Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. His latest book is called Neutrino Hunters, The Thrilling Chase for a Ghostly Particle to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in collaboration with Scientific American, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Professor Ray Jawarana, who has written a book called Neutrino Hunters. It is published by Scientific American and Farrar, Straus & Giroux. What was Wolfgang Pauli hoping to explain when he first proposed the existence of neutrinos in 1930?
Well, he was trying to solve a crisis in physics, because it looked like for more than a decade, all the experiments that scientists did suggested whenever there was beta decay, a type of radioactive decay called beta decay, some energy seemed to go missing. And that violated a hallowed principle of physics, which is that energy conservation. In other words, what goes in must equal what comes out. So Pauli suggested a new particle as possibly carrying away that energy and therefore account for that missing bit.
But it was invisible at the time.
It absolutely was. And it also was a radical step back then, because only two other matter particles were known back then. Not even the neutron had been identified yet. Only the electron and the proton were known. So it was a radical step for Pauli to suggest a whole new particle as a way of, you know, it almost felt like a cop-out to a way of getting out of a bind.
Well, we've discovered that a number of cop-outs, Einstein made one as well, turn out to be pretty good science. But how did the scientific community react to his theory at the time?
Well, they were desperate. And some of them thought this was a brilliant idea. But others also thought, well, how would we ever detect it? How could we ever test whether Pauli is right or not? Pauli was quite a colorful character. He was brash. He didn't hold back his opinions. So he was an interesting guy. And he was also actually right before he kind of invented or, you know, came up with the idea for a neutrino, dealing with a personal crisis of his own. His mother had died recently, and his father married a woman that Pauli despised. And Pauli's own marriage was coming apart. And in fact, it was only barely 9 days after his divorce was finalized that Pauli wrote a letter to his colleagues in which he proposed the idea of a neutrino.
Although he didn't call it a neutrino.
He didn't. He called it a neutron at first because he needed it to be a neutral particle, no electric charge. But when a more massive particle was found and was called the neutron, the name had to change. And it was Enrico Fermi, who was an Italian scientist who did take Pauli's idea very seriously, that came up with the name neutrino, Italian for little neutral one.
What role did James Chadwick play in this story?
Well, James Chadwick was involved in these measurements of radioactive decay and from about 1914 realized that some energy went missing. Enrico Fermi was the one who actually put on a firm theoretical footing Pauli's original idea and took it seriously. A number of other people...
He incorporated the idea of the neutrino into his theory of beta decay.
Exactly. And you know, that made it sort of seem much more sensible and serious and opened the way for possibly someday identifying it through experiment.
And then a question that I've always wanted to ask, what is weak nuclear interaction or force?
Oh, it's just one of the four fundamental forces of nature that we know about. And the neutrino only interacts with that. That's the reason that it's so hard to pin down, because it doesn't because it has no electric charge. It doesn't feel electromagnetic force, and it doesn't interact through what's called the strong force, which is what holds the nucleus together. So it's very difficult to pin down because it does only feel the weak interaction.
How did Fermi's theory of weak interaction change the scientific community's understanding of particle physics?
Well, in some way, it foreshadowed the fourth force, a fundamental force of nature that hadn't really been appreciated up to that point. It also opened the way for possibly someday figuring out experimental methods for identifying and measuring the nature of neutrinos. There are a number of other really colorful characters that got interested and involved in the search for and in the characterization of neutrinos.
Well, Fermi joined Robert Oppenheimer in the Manhattan Project. Did neutrinos play any part in the theories that led to the creation of the atomic bomb?
Actually, the physics community's attention was taken over by the Second World War on both sides of the Atlantic. So to a large extent, the study of neutrinos took a step back. However, people realized that when you have a nuclear bomb explosion, that produces a humongous burst of neutrinos. So in the end, it actually came around that soon after the war, it was a couple of scientists at Los Alamos who had worked on the Manhattan Project that first thought of, they were looking for new ideas of what to do with their professional lives and came up with the idea of seriously chasing the neutrino. And that's how, in the early 1950s, they were able to, for the first time, identify neutrinos experimentally.
Well, one of the people working with neutrinos wasn't asked to join the Manhattan Project. That was Bruno Pontecorvo. Was that because people knew he was a communist?
Quite possibly. So he was this Italian physicist. He was part of Fermi's group back in Rome. So he had a close connection to Fermi, who was very much involved in the Manhattan Project, and yet he wasn't asked to join. There was a lot of suspicion that he might be at least a sympathizer with the communists. His brother was a committed socialist, and in during his time in France, he came into contact with a lot of people with socialist ideas. He emigrated to the United States and then later to Canada, where he worked in a nuclear reactor lab, and eventually he moved to Britain. And in the summer of 1951, in the late summer of 1951, while on a holiday on the European continent with his family, he suddenly disappeared. One day, this fairly well-known nuclear physicist disappears with his family. And there was immediate suspicion and headlines around the world that a nuclear physicist might have defected to the Soviet Union, gone behind the Iron Curtain.
And had
with
he?
Some, it turned out he had. Though it's not clear that he was ever a spy or that he carried any nuclear secrets, that's not clear.
Well, but Klaus Fuchs was the one who did most of the spying in this area.
But Pontecorvo actually worked in the same lab in England as Klaus Fuchs, which is, you know, which really, you can imagine, added fuel to the suspicions.
Now, Pontecorvo is the one who suggested that neutrinos might not have a zero mass, as had been previously theorized.
Yeah.
That was an important step.
Absolutely. And also he actually thought of ways of detecting the neutrino. So some of the later physicists used his ideas, such as using dry cleaning fluid and using these gigantic tanks underground as ways of searching for neutrinos.
Another person involved in the story is Ettore Majorana. He also disappeared mysteriously, and we don't know what happened to him.
I know, that's an even more mysterious disappearance. In the case of Pontecorvo, he showed up in Russia and he continued to be active as a scientist. In the case of Majorana, he was this reclusive, brilliant genius who suddenly disappeared, presumably while taking a boat from Sicily back to Naples, where he had a position at a university. All indications were that he was coming back to work the following Monday, and yet his family never saw him again, his colleagues never saw him again, and there was a lot of mystery surrounding his disappearance. No traces were ever found. There was a lot of speculation whether he had a crisis of faith and joined a monastery, whether he had absconded to South America, whether the mob had gotten to him. There were all kinds of crazy speculation, so much so that there were Majorana sightings in Italy for quite a while, just like we talk about Elvis sightings here in America.
Well, maybe he was attacked by the antiparticles. He's the one who got who theorized about neutrinos having there being anti-neutrinos.
Absolutely.
And that he suggested that neutrinos might behave identically to their antimatter twins. What would that mean if that theory is correct?
Yeah, it seems like a simple idea, and it's an idea from so long ago, and yet it's only now that we can start to experimentally test that. And if that turns out to be true, that might allow us to understand how the universe came to be dominated by matter. Because if you think back to when the Big Bang happened, there should have been equal amounts of matter and antimatter produced out of that initial birth of the universe. And yet, the universe is totally dominated by matter now, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So there must have been a slight asymmetry that occurred at some point. And physicists really struggled to explain the origin of that asymmetry. And one of the more compelling suggestions has been that neutrinos may allow us to understand that. And that explanation has a lot to do with whether neutrinos and antineutrinos are identical in every way or not.
But that would suggest that, at least in the case of neutrinos, there isn't asymmetry.
We don't know for sure yet. Exactly. That's one of, you know, that is being experimentally investigated right now.
Now, I mentioned that neutrinos were first really confirmed in 1956. Pauli was still alive.
Yes, and he celebrated with a case of champagne, it seems.
How were they confirmed?
They were confirmed by these two scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project, had initially actually thought of what might seem like a totally wacky idea, which is to use, you know, to have a test bomb explode and try to detect the burst of neutrinos coming out of that. Luckily, that's not the route they took. Instead, they used a neutrino beam coming out of a nuclear reactor to detect. And they had to build a particular kind of contraption to do so. And later on, as we talked about, Ray Davis also was able to detect neutrinos coming from the sun, which is a naturally, you know, natural source of neutrinos, not a man-made source.
And is the Homestake mine still being used to trap neutrinos?
There's a lot happening there right now. There's a lot of discussion about turning it into an underground physics laboratory for frontier physics, including a neutrino experiment. It's not clear that the funding would come together. But there are a number of other places, one of which I got to visit in northern Ontario near Sudbury, where you, in an active nickel mine, there's the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which played a crucial role in solving the solar neutrino mystery. You go down this sort of elevator cage with couple of dozen miners at 7 o'clock in the morning, descend into the bowels of the earth, and then you have to trek through about a mile and a half of a muddy, dusty, dirty tunnel, and then you come up to the lab entrance, and you go through this elaborate cleaning ritual. You have to change your overalls, go take a shower, go walk through an air shower, wear a hairnet, all of these things, and you end.
What are they afraid you're going to contaminate?
That you're going to bring in possibly radioactive material with you into the lab, and that would interfere their measurements. So outside is this grimy mine. Inside is one of the world's cleanest places. It's quite a contrast that struck me when I visited. And in there is a gigantic vat that has been used for a long time now to detect neutrinos coming from the sun. And they're also building new experiments there at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory that would be able to detect neutrinos of different types.
Do you think we'll ever be able to see a neutrino?
Well, not in the way that you would see it with your own naked eyes, but certainly we can see the reactions and the signals they leave behind.
Now, how does this all fit in with the attempt to come up with a standard model theory of almost everything? It's still, so far, quantum mechanics and Einsteinian physics do not really work 100% together. And that's why string theory has been proposed, although not everybody goes along with it. Where does neutrino fit in with some of the new ideas of how to reconcile the two?
Well, so the standard model of particle physics, which was developed starting in the 1970s, has been remarkably successful at explaining a lot of the shenanigans of the subatomic world, and is actually been tested with exquisite precision by numerous experiments. But the original standard model assigned a mass of zero to the neutrino. But now we know that neutrinos do have some mass because they do oscillate among these three flavors, and therefore neutrinos are not massless particles. So that's already the first sort of experimental evidence that we might need to go beyond the standard model to build a construct or develop a more encompassing kind of theory that could account for phenomena that are not fully accounted for by the standard model.
And that the whole business of mass was dealt with the super Kamiokande in Japan?
Indeed.
That they were looking at the supernova 1987A, the one that you mentioned earlier, that we saw explode and then understood that neutrinos were streaming toward
coming
us.
From it, yeah.
But of course, they were many light years away. How quickly do neutrinos move?
Well, they move at nearly the speed of light. And in fact, because neutrinos can get out of the core of the star's explosion unhindered, they got here before visible light. Few hours before the astronomers saw the supernova in visible light, the neutrinos had already arrived. And the reason for that is not because neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light, but because they got out from the core of the star to the outside faster, whereas the photons had to bounce around and took some time to get out. So they really do allow you to peer deep into where the action unfolds.
So here we are at a point where we are thinking about what we can do with the neutrinos, but where we do now have a pretty good idea of what they are.
We do, and yet there are still a few mysteries left.
Ray Jayawardena, his book, Neutrino Hunters, it's published by Scientific American, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.